Hello everybody, welcome to another edition of the AfriCast. My name is Brendan Lotz and joining me today is Robin Lee Chetty. How are you doing, man?
Yeah, I'm remote.
Remote. Yes, we are still chatting to each other remotely. Thanks to the power of the internet, as Boogie21988, I think his name, I don't know, whatever. AfriCast time again this week. Let's kick it off with talking a bit about the news headlines, or some of the more important news headlines. Robin, what have you got for us from this week?
Yeah, I wouldn't class this necessarily as vital or important, but it is worthwhile noting anyway. The second generation of iPhone SE was revealed by Apple this week. The manufacturer was actually rumored to be revealing this device last week, but it never materialized, I'm assuming because of the Easter weekend. But it has materialized now. And as it did with the previous generation of iPhone SE, this newer version borrows the body from an old generation of iPhone, specifically the iPhone 8. So it's got the iPhone 8 body. So it's also got a home button, for example, and there's no notch on the screen as well. It's, however, been powered by quite a few important elements internally. Specifically, there's a new A30 Bionic chipset that's being used in this device, and that's doing a lot of the heavy lifting, not just on the processor side of things, but also on the camera side of things. So, that's the next generation of iPhone SE. We're not too sure yet as to local availability and pricing, but overseas, rather in the States, at least, it's going to be shipping, or at least available to purchase, on 24th April. So South Africa will still be under lockdown during that time. So yeah, we just have to wait and see what's going to happen for us, or rather when local consumers can get their hands on the device. But yeah, it looks like a solid device. Whether or not people want to pay $399 for it is another question.
I've just been seeing...
But that's never stopped Apple in the past.
Yeah. I mean, I'm just talking about the merits of the device. I've seen quite a few of the industry's talking heads, like Android Authority and those sorts of folks, Marques Brownlee, kind of chatting about it and saying that it doesn't look too bad. And I mean, I think that's fine, given that it is one of the lower, I don't want to say lower tier iPhones, although it really is compared to the premium stuff. But maybe this is where phones are going.
I think it's probably where Apple needs to go. I know that from their latest figures, the iPhone XR, which was, I guess, a slightly lower spec version of the XS, was one of their best-selling devices for the year.
Oh, wow.
So there obviously is an appetite in kind of that premium mid-range space, so I'm guessing this is another offering to kind of address that.
Oh, fair enough. And it is, like you say, it's a space that Apple should really be occupying, especially given the current state of the world. And will we ever need a premium smartphone ever again? We'll have to wait and see, I suppose. Moving on with news, sticking with cell phones, ironically, is ICASA assigning temporary spectrum as to help alleviate some of the connectivity issues that have presented themselves since lockdown came about, or even before lockdown even. So ICASA has announced that it has assigned temporary spectrum for mobile network operators in the 700 megahertz, 800 megahertz, 2300 megahertz, 2600 megahertz, and 3500 megahertz bands. Though the main people who have been assigned spectrum are Telkom, Vodacom, and MTN. That's for the majority of the bands. They've each been assigned a specific amount of spectrum within those bands. But then we see, like, Rain Networks, for instance, was granted 30 megahertz in the 2600 megahertz band. What was very interesting to me as well is looking at the assignment for the 3500 megahertz band. The reason that this is very interesting is because that this band is sort of primed for 5G. It's probably one of the best bands for 5G at the moment in terms of widespread commercial use. Let me put that out there. And the spectrum in this regard is limited. There's only 116 megahertz in this band. And it was divvied up quite, strictly. So for instance, Telkom had it applied for 32 megahertz, but only got 12 megahertz of that. Telco, and that's because it already has 28 megahertz in that band. And I think it was MTN as well, was also only given 50 of the 70 megahertz it applied for. Liquid Telecom got 4 megahertz in that 3500 megahertz band, and then Vodacom got 50. The last thing I just want to mention before I put everybody to sleep is that ICASA has approved applications for use of TV white spaces in the 470 to 695 megahertz band. The companies that have been granted those had those applications approved are Matinte Communications, Levin Global, and Morai Solutions. There are some stipulations to this being granted. For instance, if the technology starts to interfere with television broadcasts, it will have to be terminated immediately, and ICASA will need to be notified. But this is really cool because it's actually, as far as I'm aware, it's the first time that there's been kind of a widespread application for TV white spaces in South Africa. I know there have been tests and there's been proof of concepts, but this is very interesting. I'd like to see how this temporary spectrum is used. Maybe we can chat to one of these three companies and maybe get some more information about it. I think it'd be really, really interesting to see how that technology is being used. For those
that, I just had one question though, just regarding, there was one local network that was curiously absent.
Cell C.
In that story, yes. Yes. What are they leveraging?
So I think the reason that we didn't see Cell C is that as part of their turnaround strategy, they are leasing infrastructure from other mobile network operators. So, for instance, they concluded a roaming agreement with MTN last year, and I think that a lot of their infrastructure is now, they are piggybacking off of other folks, because it makes sense in a regard, because it means that they are not responsible for maintenance of those sites, making sure that those networks are constantly up and running. It just makes it a little bit easier and cheaper from their perspective. So I think that the reason we didn't see anything from them is that a lot of their infrastructure is being leased. But over and above that, the spectrum isn't free, just so everybody knows. You do have to pay ICASA to be able to use the spectrum. And I think that a company like Cell C, which is slowly beginning to turn around and slowly becoming a viable firm again, not that it wasn't ever viable, but you know what I mean. I think incurring another debt, such as getting more spectrum, I think that would be a very bad idea from them.
For sure, makes sense,
Yeah, so that's how spectrum is being assigned. I do want to mention, though, as well, just final thing. I know I've been chatting for a while about this, but I do want to mention that today would have been the final day of, so Thursday would have been the final day of lockdown for South Africa. And this assignment was only announced late yesterday, early this morning. And it just seems like it was a bit delayed. I don't know, because we now have 2 more weeks of lockdown. Fair enough. This should help. This additional spectrum that's been made available, and it should help connectivity. But I do wonder why it took so long. We've seen a lot of fast turnaround from governments in other areas. It's just kind of like, this took a bit long. That having been said, I'm glad it's been done.
Well, I mean, it is, I guess, true to form. They have been dragging their feet in terms of spectrum allocation for 5G.
I mean, in comparison, this is pretty fast turnaround in comparison to what we've seen in recent years.
It is worthwhile mentioning that even if the lockdown was to end today, as it was initially planned, there's still going to be a phased approach to people heading back to work. So
absolutely.
It is interesting as to why it's taking this long. But also, I would assume that it's not like everyone is heading back to work on Monday morning.
Absolutely. That is a very fair point. And then we have some news about UNISA.
Yes. So one of our journalists, Clinton, who unfortunately isn't joining us at the moment because he is busy studying with UNISA, he wrote a story regarding the May and June exam period. And as you might expect, with a lot of things being cancelled due to COVID-19, so have the examinations for the period. So students will not be allowed to sit down and write exams in exam halls for obvious reasons.
Yeah.
But it also kind of throws into disarray some of the plans that students might have had. At this stage, there has been no further announcements as to what's going to happen with the examinations, but they will be taking different formats, whether that be online quizzes or assignments that you have to submit. Mm-hmm. It will depend on the course you're doing, and that communication is expected to happen sometime in May. So again, for UNISA students, it seems like it's a bit of a kind of sit at home, twiddle your thumbs and wait to see what happens kind of thing. So yeah, it's unfortunate, but necessary steps have to be taken considering we are currently in lockdown and we're dealing with a global pandemic.
Yeah, absolutely. As always, all links to all these stories will be at the bottom of this post or above this this podcast, as you can see. You can just click on those links and they will take you to the stories. Right, so today for the meat of our podcast, we're going to be chatting about a collaboration between Google and Apple. I know, right? Google and Apple working together. Times really are strange. Robin, you picked up the story. So do you want to start us off and just explain what this collaboration is between two of the world's biggest tech firms?
Yeah, so I think it kind of struck us as a bit interesting, purely from the fact that although Apple and Google work together on a lot of tech forums and different organizations, they very rarely do they collaborate together on a singular project.
Mm.
But they announced something on Good Friday, which is perhaps why it didn't necessarily pick up the traction locally that it might have normally done.
Mm.
But they announced a collaboration that centered around COVID-19 and in particular a COVID-19 tracing app or tool. They haven't given this project a specific designation, so for now we're just referring to it as a tracing tool. There's kind of be two phases to this project, as Apple and Google have outlined so far. Again, a lot of the finer elements and details are still being planned and still being researched, so this is still a fledgling project at this stage. But for now, what we know is that in May, the beginning of May, that both Apple and Google will be distributing APIs to their native marketplaces. So that means the App Store for Apple users and then the Play Store for Android users. It's also worth mentioning that, say, for example, Huawei, which uses Android but doesn't use the Play Store, the frameworks for the APIs will be made available to those kinds of vendors, which are for the most part Chinese.
Yeah.
And it's up to them to then kind of take it from there. So those APIs will be distributed in May, and then in the following months, that's when a Bluetooth-enabled tool will be available to users. And the kind of point of it is, should you become infected, you would notify a healthcare organization via an app, and then that essentially would trigger the Bluetooth. They refer to it as BLE, which is
low energy.
It's kind of the same kind of system you'd use when pairing a smartwatch to your phone, for example.
Yeah.
So they said that this tracing app is essentially going to work to find out who you've been in contact with since being tested positive for COVID-19. And it'll allow health organizations to kind of be able to track your movements and kind of see what potential spread you might have caused as a result. So the kind of reason we spoke about it was, one, obviously the interesting aspect of the collaboration, getting these two huge companies together, but also it also kind of raised a few red flags with officials in the United States, specifically Democratic governors and politicians who wanted to find out what the data or being tracked is going to be, what it'd be used for, and how easy it would be to hack or to compromise.
Yeah.
So Google and Android have kind of given a bit more feedback with regards to that. So the first thing to note is that this is not a location-based tool. It is proximity-based. So it won't say Robin was at McDonald's on Thursday, then he went to Mall of Africa, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
It would rather see your proximity to other devices. I would say it's slightly similar to the same process used in an application like Google Maps. Mm-hmm. But with Google Maps, there's obviously a lot more location data involved. So this is, I guess, a more stripped down version of that.
Well, I mean, to build off of what you're saying, like Google Maps does use a sort of proximity thing to measure traffic. That's how Google's able to have traffic data, is that it's reading everybody's phone in a proximity to each other. Obviously, you have to opt in and all that sort of stuff, but it's using that data to kind of build an image of what the traffic is. So they are doing this to an extent, but like you say, Robin, it's incredibly stripped down and not a location service.
Yeah, I think it's important to know that while we understand there's a desire for politicians to understand what is happening with this kind of tool, what's going to be used for, what kind of data can be pulled from it. And I think it's also something that Google and Apple are well aware of as well. So what they've said is that the service is opt-in. So a user will only have to notify if they deem it necessary, if they really want to.
Okay.
I also find it quite interesting that one of the other global tech sites, I believe it was Engadget, they pointed to a recent survey in the UK that found that 3 in 4 respondents would be open to using an app or a tool like this during a time like COVID-19, which makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
I think when you're dealing with a global pandemic, some privacy and some security needs to perhaps be, I guess, put on the back burner, for lack of a better term, as you kind of try and tackle this really huge problem.
Well, I think it's degrees, though, right? Is that it's kind of like a case of, okay, so either I'm going to lose a bit of my privacy in this regard, but if I enable this, it allows people to track where people are moving more easily. If I'm at risk, it means that a healthcare official can come and see me directly. Like, it's kind of a compromise, I think, is the better word. Is, okay, I'm going to give up some of my privacy, but at the same time, it's a really a small sacrifice compared to what I'm doing this for, the greater good, as it were.
Yeah, so I think to also kind of create a bit more clarity, Google and Apple invited a bunch of journalists in the States to sit down in a panel discussion and kind of hash out what this plan is going to be, what the tool is actually going to be used for. When they were asked, they did explain that no non-governmental organizations would have access to it. So as far as I understand, that means that only healthcare organizations should have access to this kind of information.
Yeah.
They also mentioned that privacy is going to be a huge part of it. So I guess what we're saying is that Google and Apple are well aware of the fact that this kind of application or tool can be used for good. It can also be used for, I guess, nefarious means. But the way it's been built so far is to ensure that there is no compromising data that's going to be involved, or it will be extremely difficult for a hacker to pull compromising data off of it.
Or indeed, and I think for it kind of a company to abuse data like this, I'm sure.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
I think it more importantly highlights the fact that even though we are living in chaotic times and we have to sometimes sacrifice a lot of the privacy that we enjoy and are entitled to, we still need to be critical and kind of scrutinize a lot of the technology that we are using, regardless of how it's intended to be used.
Oh, absolutely. I think that is a very important point to raise, Robin, is that, I mean, we're not saying to everybody, oh, privacy is dead, give up your privacy. It's more a case of, well, we all need to make sacrifices at this juncture, and giving up your proximity data to an organization such as Apple and Google. And I know that these companies haven't exactly garnered the most trust in people. Maybe not so much Google and Apple as so much Facebook, but I mean, just looking.
Well, I mean, you look at Apple, for example.
Yeah.
And the whole scrubbing of audio from Siri.
Yeah.
That was something that wasn't made known to the public. So they haven't had necessarily the best track record. So I do appreciate the fact that they're being more open and honest as in terms of how this is going to work.
Yeah,
beyond your point.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's the first thing I want to say is it's very nice that they were so transparent, inviting journalists, letting them ask as many questions as they could, explaining how things are going to work. That builds up goodwill, because it shows that, okay, we're actually going to tell you about what we're doing. We're not just going to do this on the sly and not tell anybody. It's, this is what we want to do. We want to help, and these companies are best suited to do this. Let's not beat around the bush. Google and Apple are the only types of phones you can get outside of China, of course. I mean, there's obviously Huawei and other Chinese brands and other brands, but I think the main two are Apple and Google. You either have an Android phone or you have an Apple if you're listening to this right now in South Africa. And their reach is immense, and it allows them to do stuff like this because they just have that reach, you know? And like you said, like, I am the first person to worry about my privacy. Okay, like, I do take precautions. Obviously, there are some things that I just can't do, you know? Like, I can't be completely anonymous because my Twitter link and my social links are all over our website. My name is all over the internet. Like, but there are some things that I realize I can't control in terms of privacy. Do I hate it? Sometimes, yes. But sometimes I understand that there are certain sacrifices that I need to make in order for things to function more properly. For instance, I don't necessarily want Google to know where I am all the time, but I do enjoy using maps because I don't like using a map book. So I make the sacrifice of Google knowing where I am all the time in order to make use of services such as maps. Now, there are other things to consider within that, like, do I want to be advertised every time I'm within close proximity to a brand? Not necessarily, but there's certain sacrifices. What I like about this solution, though, is that it's not asking folks to sacrifice anything more than, hey, we need to install a piece of software on your phone that's going to tell us if you're in proximity to somebody who's had COVID-19, or tell us that you are perhaps at risk and need to seek medical attention. I don't think it's as bad as something like, oh, hey, what was their name? I completely forget their name now. The Facebook folks. Cambridge Analytica has been secretly viewing user data for years now. I think it's a completely different level to that, what Google and Apple are doing here.
I think if people are concerned about potentially their data being compromised, it's important that, one, obviously, that it's based off of proximity. The only time that you would be sharing data or information is with the healthcare apps, the official healthcare apps that might be operating on your phone. So, say for example, if you are someone that's been in contact with a person that's tested positive for COVID-19, you will receive a notification on your device regardless of what Apple and Google are saying about the system.
Yeah.
So even if you don't have the app, you will be notified, which I think is helpful. From there, if you are then in contact with a official healthcare organization by an app, that's when you start sharing information such as your name.
But that's with government. That's with government, though, not Google and Apple.
Yeah, so I think what's important to keep in mind here is that Apple and Google aren't getting access to information. Yeah. They are simply the mediators for healthcare organizations to have more accurate access.
And to be able to take advantage of the swathes of data that Google and Apple have access to, and users obviously as well, not just going to call people data. But so I also want to bring, while we're talking about this, is that South Africa is doing something similar in terms of track and trace with a system that's being developed by the CSIR. And one of the things that was mentioned in that situation was that once we are beyond this situation, the data will be kept that they keep from this, or that they collect during this track and trace, but it'll be anonymized and it's kept for research purposes. So that if something like this happens again, you can kind of use that data as a jumping off point. Did Google or Apple say anything about what happens after this outbreak? What happens to the data? Are they going to delete it? Is there anything in that regard, Robert?
At this stage, no. I've read, they haven't mentioned anything to that effect. I don't want to speak on their behalf, but I would assume that they would be operating in the same way that the CSIR are doing. Anonymizing the data and then keeping it on record for health, for organizations like the WHO to kind of have on hand and kind of see, because it will be at least helpful from a planning perspective the next time a pandemic like this happens, that they can see, they can really map more accurately how it's spread, identifying hotspots and plan accordingly. So yeah, I'm not too sure what they're going to be doing with it, but I assume it'll be similar to what this CSIR have kind of outlined.
So, in terms of how this stuff is going to get onto your phone, users, you say users will have to opt in, so they will have to go to the Apple App Store or to the Google Play Store and download a specific application. That's correct, right? I'm
That's
understanding
right,
that's
yeah, that's
correct.
good.
Okay, so it has to, like you say, it's something that people must actively opt into. It's not just something that's being installed on their device and, oh, now Google can see everything that I'm
So
doing.
then let me rather clarify this.
Yeah.
So it will be distributed regardless.
Okay.
The opt-in is to whether you want to start sharing information
Okay. All right. That's a lot
with
clearer.
a healthcare organization app or any kind of app. So say for example, and again, I think it's important that this kind of tool is there regardless, really for the fact that if you have been in contact with someone that has tested positive for COVID-19, you will get notified. I think that's something that everyone would want to know if that was the
Yeah.
case.
Absolutely.
And it's also important because people don't necessarily have connectivity or access to data to always be on an app. So to have this tool only be downloaded once or being ported over the air once and then having it always available, I think makes a lot more sense than having them have to have access to an app all the time.
Yeah, fair enough. You know, and especially, it's not just a problem in South Africa, it's a problem around the world. I read a survey today that was conducted by OnePoll, and in the States, connectivity is one of the biggest issues for people who are working from home. So it's not just an issue in South Africa. I think it's an issue around the world in terms of connectivity.
For
So
sure.
what I would like to say though is that it's really nice that they have considered that, because a lot of the time these solutions are created in America and it's only those folks that are considered. But yeah, it's really nice that Google has it's clearly that diversity that they've been talking up is starting to show. So that's really good. I want to ask you, Robin, how do you feel about this? How do you feel about sharing of data and folks being able to contact you and know where you've moved and that sort of stuff, especially during this time.
I think I'm a lot like you, just in terms of my privacy. I mean, I don't even like signing in when I go to places and security give me something to, but they want to scan my driver's license. I get really upset about that. But that's perhaps another podcast discussion. I understand the need for it. I think this is a global pandemic, and like we mentioned previously, some of your privacy has to be sacrificed. I do, however, think that we have to hold these kind of companies and these kinds of solutions to account, and we need to ensure that they are properly scrutinized, regardless of how helpful they will be in the long term. I think it's extremely important for us to ensure that the data that they have or the data that they are using is used in the correct way.
Absolutely.
I'm willing to sacrifice, but at the same time, I'm not going to
Download and
change my
forget.
thought. Yeah, I'm not going to change my thoughts and ethics when it comes to privacy and data, but I am willing to sacrifice it in these kind of chaotic times.
Absolutely. I 100% agree with you. And I think that the point you raise about making sure that they are ethical and how they're using this data now and in the future, I think that's the important part, is that at the moment, nobody knows when this situation is going to end. Not the World Health Organization, not Donald Trump. Nobody knows when the situation is going to end. We could lift lockdowns and there's a second pandemic wave. Like anything could happen from here on out. We do not know. But with that in mind, I think it's important to keep solutions that we've implemented, such as this, such as the track and trace program. I think it's important that we keep those things top of mind so that when this is all over, we can go back to the powers that be and say, hey, okay, where's this and this and this? What's happening with these things? Have they been discontinued? Are you still collecting data? How do we know? Can we check these things? Like, there needs to be an accountability from the powers that be as well. It's not just, hey, we're sacrificing our privacy for the greater good for nothing. It's on the condition that this is going to help us. And in, when it's all over, you get rid of these things. Because, like, I understand why they're in place, and I get it. But at the same time, I don't want my privacy on a normal Tuesday to be, to just be abused by government because they can. I think that that's where things get very, very dangerous, and the issues of privacy then become issues of your rights. And that's where things start to get dangerous.
I think something that's going to be important down the line is what happens to this tool once it's been used for the purpose it was built.
Mm-hmm.
Would it be removed from phones in future? Those are questions that also need to be answered. And was there any kind of time frame that the CSIR outlined for their solution?
To answer your question, Robin, they haven't said explicitly when it will end. They did outline how the data will be treated once this is all over, once the need for track and trace has expired. That, as I mentioned, includes anonymizing data, keeping some of the data on record, but in terms of the tracking and tracing, that would cease. When that will end, however, is unclear. How long is a piece of string, really? But yeah, so like we mentioned, like you said, it's important that we keep these solutions that are being presented to us top of mind, so that when all of this is over, we can say, hey guys, could you stop tracking me? I'd really appreciate that. You don't need to know that I'm going to the shops now.
For sure, yeah, 100%.
And yeah, I think that's going to do it from us for this week, unless there was something else you wanted to mention, Robin, regarding this.
Regarding this, I think we still have to wait and see what's going to happen.
Yeah.
You mentioned beginning of May is when the APIs roll out, and then in the coming months, that's when the actual Bluetooth tool comes out. So we have to kind of wait and see how it's going to pan out. We still have a lot of lingering questions in terms of what's going to happen there. So,
It's also a case of governments buying into this. Sorry, I know we're closing off, but have any governments said that they would be buying into this program from Google and Apple?
Both organizations say they're reaching out to governments.
Okay.
So I guess kind of the ball is in their court.
Okay.
In that regard, but I think they have sovereignty just in terms of how the operating systems.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Operate, sorry. So I don't think they have to worry necessarily about how governments feel about it.
Okay.
Also, if they are working with someone like the WHO, I think they are pretty well vetted in that regard.
Well, as long as they are working towards that and working with governments, I think that's good. Rather than just being like, hey, we've got this tool, and government's like, what? We don't need that, but I think a lot of governments will find it really, really useful. But anyway, that's it from us for this week. Enjoy your shorter weekend, I guess. It is no long weekend this weekend, but it has been a shorter week. We will chat again next week, remote as always. But from myself, Brendan Lotz, from Robin Chetty.
Yeah, stay home, stay safe, all those good things.
Yeah, and we'll see you next week. Cheerio.
Cheers.
Sorry, the number you have dialed is not in service at this time.